77 WABC. And now, the longest-running program in the history of 77 WABC, Religion on the Line, with Rabbi Joseph Potasnik and Deacon Kevin McCormick.
Good morning and welcome to Religion on the Line. I'm Rabbi Joseph Potasnik.
I'm sitting in for the deacon, and I'm Alan Abramson.
All right, and the deacon is in a most unenviable position today. He's listening, but he can't speak. So that is not a great place for a member of the clergy, but I know he'll bear with it, and he'll return next week. But he's taking some time off. Well-deserved. Puts in a lot of work into his school, into radio. Anything he does with a full heart. And just it's an honor to be with him every week. And Alan, thank you. For coming in.
It's really an honor to be here, and I appreciate the opportunity, and I thank you and the deacon for the opportunity.
All right. You know, there is an interesting commentary. Years ago, we had a wonderful rabbi named Israel Leventhal, Brooklyn Jewish Center, and he looked at a passage in the Bible where the Israelites are walking through the Red Sea, and there were walls on the right and walls on the left, and Leventhal noted that the word for walls can also be interpreted as hatred. If you just change it a bit, hatred on the right, hatred on the left. And I look at what's happening this weekend. Let's talk about the hatred on the right. Because you know what happens very often. You mention hatred, everybody points in all different directions, looking in one particular direction. So we have the tragic anniversary of Charlottesville. And there are going to be people in Washington, D.C., Unite the Right. What I find very interesting is some of these people used to wear hoods. No longer. It's out in the open. There are going to be some, some display of hatred, even in Charlottesville, even though there no permits were granted. But it's a sad commentary that after all the years and all we've been through as a country, that we still have vestiges of this hatred, in this case, on the right. We'll talk about the left later on, but right now on the right, on the extreme right.
Well, I think one of the most extraordinary things about Charlottesville is that the groups on the right, the Nazis, the Klansmen, they felt free not to wear hoods, not to wear masks. They have been emboldened. They feel that they are accepted. They feel that they have a voice in the mainstream now. And it is one of the first times in my memory that you have seen those groups feel comfortable enough to march in public, be seen on television, be identified, be proud of what they're doing, and not be afraid of law enforcement. Not be afraid of being shamed in public. When I say shamed in public, being identified in public and the consequences that would have for them throughout their life, they feel like they have arrived and that they now have a seat at the table. And that was the most disturbing thing to me about Charlotte, besides the damage and the message that they were trying to convey, but the comfort level that they had, the feel that they had arrived. And now they have a place where their voice will be heard and listened to.
As someone noted, the sewer covers are off. And those that were in the sewer and were saying things that couldn't be seen or heard publicly are now proudly proclaiming their vitriol for all to hear. I thought to myself, all right, we're going to lament. We're going to complain. What do we do about it? I would say if I were in power, if I had the opportunity to convene a national summit on racism in this country, that to me would be an appropriate response. Every president, regardless of political affiliation, has an obligation, has an opportunity to bridge gaps. And we really miss opportunities when we don't do so. So to me, the best or the fitting response to Charlottesville is bring parties together at a table, one table, the right, the left. Let's talk about what we can do if we're really serious about bridging gaps. If all we want to do is continue the divide, then we do nothing. But it's going to take a lot more than simple statements. It's going to take a lot more than tweets. It's going to take a lot more than people expressing you know, their dismay. It's going to require people of conscience really saying enough is enough. We've experienced too much of this. Let's sit together. Let's try to find solutions. Let's listen to one another. We don't listen to one another. We just, when I say we, I'm talking, you know, in the generic. There are many people who simply don't listen. All they do is they express their point of view. They're not interested in your point of view because what do you know? It's they who know everything. Unfortunately, that's not happening.
Well, and I think there's something else we have to consider. It's you also have to consider how your words are heard by other people. Look, and I'm not trying to be political about this, but there was a host on a show on Fox the other day that made a statement about immigration and its effect on the American culture. And the next day she came on and said, look, you're misunderstanding me. This was not about race. And I take her at her word. But here's the problem. The first reaction to it, public reaction, was from David Duke, who is the Grand Wizard of the Ku Klux Klan. And he said that her statement was the most important statement on race that he had ever heard on the mainstream media. Well, if David Duke could see that statement and interpret that statement and hold that statement up to his people as the most important statement on race ever heard on mainstream media, you have to be careful. And I don't mean the government censor your words, but I think you have to be careful how your words can be interpreted.
You know, I listened to some of the statements she made, and she said, this is not the America I knew or the America we knew. And I thought to myself, when Jews arrived in this country years ago, I'm sure that those were saying, gee, this is not the Americans we have here. Or when the Irish arrived, the Italians arrived, any immigrant group arriving, you always had those who feel they don't gel. They're not compatible with the composition in America.
No, people of a certain age don't remember the signs about no Irish, no Italians.
Right.
No, I mean, it was rampant. They didn't want Europeans coming over here, and they were poor.
I remember years ago meeting with Marty Glickman, and great, you know, athlete, sports commentator, and he traveled with Jesse Owens, and they would arrive at a hotel, and the clerk would say, well, that guy who's black, he can't stay here. You can. I don't know if he knew that Glickman was Jewish, and Glickman would say, if he can't stay here, I'm not staying here. But that was in this country not that long ago.
No.
And I'm sure there were those who were saying, looking at those two guys, gee, America's changing. That's not the America we knew.
Yeah.
All right, we're going to take a break and come back with more Religion on the Line.
77 WABC. Rabbi Joseph Potasnik and Deacon Kevin McCormick. 77 WABC.
Welcome back, Religion Online. I'm Rabbi Joseph Potasnik.
And I'm sitting in for the deacon, and I'm Alan Abramson.
I don't think there's any secret we're talking about Laura Ingraham before, just as when Ann Coulter makes statements that we think are outrageous, we call her out. Look, we need a robust debate. I told you during the break, Alan, that I often read material, Ben Shapiro, for example, who does a program on ABC. He's got the Ben Shapiro Reports, and you subscribe to it. Now, Ben can take any position, but he's willing to defend the position and to debate others. And what he says is not done to offend. It's done from what he thinks a legitimate point of view, and he's ready to listen to other points of view. That's the spirit that we need in this country, and unfortunately we don't have. We are the country now where people think it's best to put others down who disagree with them. You see, that's why I have to tell you, and I mention this so often, I have now taken emails that I find offensive from those who are the chronic, you know, trolls, and they go right into junk. I don't read them because they contribute nothing to the debate. And there are so many other people with credentials who can offer something substantive that you could look at and say, look, I like it, I don't like it, or I don't agree with it, but I'm ready to read it. And that's why I say a national summit on racism, which should have been done a long time ago, but a national summit on racism is something that's required now to really address what's gone on in this country for too long. That, to me, is the best response to Charlottesville.
I absolutely agree. It has to be a robust debate people have to be willing to hear things that they don't want to hear. I was listening to a program the other day on one of the cable networks, and it was really – it was heartbreaking to hear. They had two women who were talking about a monument in, I believe, Stone Mountain, Georgia.
Mm-hmm.
And an African-American woman was talking about the pain it caused to that the symbol of Stone Mountain caused her family. And she was in tears when she described it. And the other woman that was there also burst into tears because she said, I have nothing but fond memories of this place. My father used to take me here. This was my childhood. This was a wonderful place. And I didn't know the pain that it was causing other people. And I have to think about this now.
Mm-hmm.
And she wanted to talk to her later off the air, but it was so interesting. It was a live moment on TV, but to see both people who neither one had had the background of the other, but to see them have that moment together and react together and you know, really try to understand the other's position and want to take it further after the show was over so that they could understand where they were coming from. Because they each saw that their positions were deeply held, and neither one of them was coming from an evil place or a political place. It was coming from their life experience that neither one understood of the other.
Two clips that I happened to see last night. One is the mother of Heather Heyer. She was killed,
yeah,
you know, in Charlottesville. And she said, if they thought that they were going to silence my daughter, they did just the opposite. I'm going to magnify her voice. She stood up against racial hostility, and I'm going to continue that legacy. That's number one. Number two, I was reading that it was a woman in Charlottesville who said, you know what I'm going to do? I'm joining the synagogue. They don't like Jews. I'm going to make sure they see Jews. I'm going to be part of that Jewish community. She said, for too long I was a lapsed Jew, and now I'm going to be an active Jew. To me, those kinds of things. And by the way, it's not, they don't just hate Jews. They hate Catholics. You know, there's a long list of people on there. You know, they can see the enemies of society. Wherewith, and it's a badge of honor to be hated by the KKK. It's a badge of honor to be detested by Unite the Right.
I have to tell you, I was not aware of the absolute hatred that the KKK had for Catholics until my friend Aidan O'Connor educated me a few years ago about it, and I did research, and I was astounded. But absolutely, Catholics are right up there with the Jews. They despise Catholics. But there was one other positive thing that I saw. One of the member of the Nazi group that marched in Charlottesville, he was featured on a program the other night. He's had an amazing experience. He met a black pastor who treated him very, very well and invited him into the church and wanted to hear his testimony. Well, long story short, he's been baptized by the black minister. I actually saw the baptism ceremony. He has now renounced his membership in the group.
Okay.
He's hooked up with this sort of an underground railroad now to help members of these skinhead groups and Nazi groups and nationalist groups get out of the groups because it's not that easy. But there is a redemption movement in helping people to see. There was, he was so touched by the love that he'd been shown by the black minister that It turned him. Nobody had ever shown him that sort of love and understanding.
I think I read about him. Can I mention CNN on the station? But on CNN tonight, I think he's going to be on because he is working to remove people from the hate movements. He says, I know how to speak their language, and I'm going to devote my life now to extricating those who are trapped in that hatred from there. So, you know, kudos to him and those who support him. You see, we can talk about racism in our congregations. It's important. We need to address hatred. The problem I find is it's the ones who are not sitting there, the ones who aren't there in the various communities. Those are the ones, you know, who need the sermon. And above all, as has been said many times, it's not enough to hear a sermon. You have to see a sermon. So all of us need to be connected to coalitions that try to bring people together. because the extremes will never do anything meaningful. They will just contribute to the hatred. I am amazed sometimes by people who thrive on hatred. Their whole identity is defined by hatred, right? It's easy to be, they feel they're victims or whatever they feel, but they spew this venom, which does nothing except vitiate relationships with one another, and they want to portray people always as the enemy. There are no more adversaries, Alan.
No.
Everybody's an enemy. No. There's no adversary. You have adversaries in court, but the rest of the world, you know, we have enemies. I want to talk to you one quick thing before we get to break, and we're going to be back with Evan Bernstein, who is the regional director of ADL. Great guy, and I've known Evan for some time. And he'll give us, you know, an accurate description of what's going on with hatred in this country. Paul Manafort is sitting there listening to all the testimony. Besides thinking, I wish I had hired Alan Abramson as my attorney, what goes through his mind?
Well, it's a complicated question. Part of the time, every time your lawyer is asking a question and his lawyer was cross-examining Gates, as they were chipping away at his credibility, you know, you begin to become emboldened. You're thinking, you know, I'm making progress here, and, you know, you're getting your hopes built up. But he's got a long road here. The government put in a very, very powerful case. Uh-huh. He's hoping. He's praying.
Okay. When we come back, as I mentioned, Evan Bernstein of ADL. And then later on, let me mention a surprise guest, which is not a surprise to you because, you know, I came back from Israel with the great Mariano Rivera. So we're going to be talking with number 42. This is a Boston fan praising a Yankee. This, you know, painful this is for me today, but I'm a Mariano fan for some time. Stay tuned. Religion on the line. News
77 WABC. And now, the longest-running program in the history of 77 WABC, Religion on the Line, with Rabbi Joseph Potasnik and Deacon Kevin McCormick.
Does that make me the longest-running rabbi in the history of WABC? Or fast-walking? Welcome back, Religion Online. I'm Rabbi Joseph Potasnik.
Sitting in for Deacon McCormick, I'm Alan Abramson.
All right. By the way, so I went to Israel. And, you know, my mother always taught me when you go on a plane, when you have your luggage taken, put a red string around it so when you get off the plane, you can identify it easily.
I think you have the same mothers.
Yeah,
it's all
500
red, string.
Red strings. That's all you see are the red strings on suitcases. All right, let's go to a great human being and a terrific guy. He's become a friend, a close friend for some time, and I value his insight. And I'm talking about Evan Bernstein, who's the regional director of the Anti-Defamation League. Good morning, Evan.
Hi, Rabbi. Hi, Alan. Good to be on the show.
Thanks. Thanks for being
morning,
with us.
Evan.
So we're looking at this anniversary of Charlottesville. This very tragic, the fact we have to have an anniversary for something that should never have occurred. And the question people are asking is, so what has changed? What have we learned? Where are we? Where are we going?
Listen, I don't think a lot has changed. The big difference that we've seen since Charlottesville is that a lot of the white supremacist groups have taken their things back online, back into the kind of out without not being in front of people the way they were in Charlottesville. I think, you know, after Charlottesville, you know, Richard Spencer and some of the other white supremacist groups that were there planned to convene in multiple other cities after Charlottesville. And once Vice TV and other coverage took place and people lost their jobs and people got outed and the American public started to see what they were all about with the tiki torches and, you know, blood and soil and Jews will not replace us, it pushed them back underground to a certain extent. So to say that it's not there, a lot of people I talk to say, well, you know, they haven't met, you know, well, they're still convening. They're just not doing it in the public square in the same way. They're doing it online. They're doing it on Twitter. They're doing it, you know, in blogospheres. They're doing it in other locations. And it doesn't mean by any stretch of the imagination that there's any less movement within the white supremacist groups around this country. And a lot of the people I've spoken to are worried about what's going to happen, you know, on the anniversary here in Washington, D.C., as groups are coming together again, and there's been filings for groups to come together, white supremacist groups to be able to come together. But it's not a lot has changed. It's just how it's being done has changed to a certain extent.
Evan, I remember speaking with Francine Rosten, a rabbi in Whitefish, Montana. Now, Whitefish, Montana, although it has the name Whitefish, is not known for the plethora of Jews who live there. And yet Richard Spencer had no problem, hate mongers had no problem going to Whitefish, Montana, and condemning, attacking Jews. So it does require, you know, a heavy Jewish population to be the recipients of their venom. It pervades so many places. They go to places where there are blacks or white. It doesn't matter who's living there. Their hatred is there.
That's right. That's right. And I think what was interesting was that the Charlottesville a year ago was the largest gathering of white supremacist groups in almost a decade. And, you know, the EDL was very involved in the demasking laws of the Ku Klux Klan, which really cut the Klan off at the legs, because once people had to show their faces, especially in the public square, to other citizens, and a lot of these people were, you know, were city leaders, judges, lawyers, you know, law enforcement officials that were members of the Klan, it really cut them off the legs. And I think they'd almost forgotten what that was like. And again, with social media, even with them gathering, you know, they were, I think, were shocked with the response and what actually happened to a lot of them by them losing their jobs. But to say that, you know, the amount of incidents that we've seen, we just put out a heat map, which shows, you know, extremist activity around the country, and especially in New York. We've seen, you know, anti-Semitic incidents and extremist incidents have gone up from 2016 from 202 to 2017 to 378. And that's a tremendous increase in those number of incidents that are taking place in New York. And, you know, and people say that it's not happening anymore, and that's just not true.
Evan, this is Alan Abramson. Look, these groups, as detestable as they are, they do have a First Amendment right, and if they do want to march, the local municipalities have an obligation to let them march and even provide appropriate law enforcement protection. But when they're underground like this, and when they are, it seems to me that oftentimes, you know, these groups can align themselves with militias and things like that. What is the Justice Department policy towards these groups? I know a few years ago there was some memos put out about these right-wing militia groups, and the Justice Department was criticized. Is there a Justice Department policy relating to how these groups are handled?
I'm not familiar with how the Justice Department is tracking these groups. I know that that we track these groups. We have a whole center on extremism. That's all they do. We have analysts. All we do is track extremist groups, these kind of groups that are on the fringe, in tracking them, because in a lot of times law enforcement can't, for the very reason you said, Alan, that there's a First Amendment right, they have freedom of speech, and also if they're not necessarily breaking the law per se, law enforcement can only hold the dossier or investigate for a certain period of time, whereas a private organization like the ADL is allowed to do that ongoing. And so a lot of times we're tracking and keeping track of these groups, militia groups, white supremacist groups, and we're able to be there for when law enforcement needs us when something does happen. A lot of times that's the case, where there'll be an incident and they'll come right to us and we have a whole dossier ready for them. And that's one of the values of our organization, is that we can, that, and why we work so closely with law enforcement is for that very reason.
Yeah, Evan, I just want to be clear to the listeners. I wasn't suggesting that law enforcement should be tracking groups because of their beliefs or because of their speech. But sure. My concern was, when that spills over, if it becomes more of a militia thing, if it becomes more of a planning of violence, that's what I was asking about, is whether the Justice Department.
Well, I think I'm not an attorney, but that's when that becomes illegal behavior, when you're planning, you know, some kind of a plot, or you're doing something that's going to be eventually harming somebody. That's the same as the free speech, even in Charlottesville, is when something crests over from being free speech and saying what you want to say and having that First Amendment right, to where it crests over to where there's violence that takes place, to where people's civil rights or physical rights are being assaulted or infringed upon. That's when the State Department and local law enforcement have to get involved, and do.
You know, I was saying before to the rabbi that one of the things that shocked me most about Charlottesville was the size of the demonstration and the fact that all of these people were there. They weren't wearing masks. They weren't wearing hoods. And they just felt so emboldened to carry those torches and to
yeah, the other side, and I would add to that, and the Jews who live there weren't wearing, they weren't concealing their identity. They weren't, there was a fear factor, obviously, but they said, we're gonna go to our synagogues, and there were Christians who were protecting Jews at synagogues. Mm-hmm. There were Jews who said, we are not going to hide who we are this Sabbath or any other day and kowtow to these hate mongers. We're going to stand proudly for what we believe is right. So, you know, they can expose their faces. We're not going to hide our faces because we're afraid of them.
No, and Mike Signer, who I've become close with, who is the mayor of Charlottesville, who's Jewish. And again, he did not hide, you know, his Judaism either, as the mayor of Charlottesville. And so, yeah, there was a proud moment for a lot of people, you know, as bad as it was and as horrific as that period was, there were some stories of people really coming together and the community trying to do the best it could, you know, under really, serious duress.
So the question that remains, Evan, and we're talking with Evan Bernstein, regional director of the Anti-Defamation League, people sitting, listening, you know, say, I want to do more than just wring my hands and, you know, just shrug at what's going on. What can I do to become more involved to counter this hatred?
There's a lot. There's a lot that can be done, Rabbi. And it starts with, you know, getting engaged beyond just writing diatribes on Facebook. From an elected official level, there are so many incidents, anti-Semitic incidents in particular, that take place in New York, where we just do not hear from elected officials. Silence. And if it's not for me or my team really, you know, jostling them, they really don't want to make a comment or say anything. And that's really up to the constituents in a given community when something happens, is to really get on the phone and contact the local elected officials, city council members, federally elected officials, and say, this is unacceptable. What are you doing as an elected to make sure this doesn't happen? And what are you doing to protect the group that's had this horrific act of hate taken against it? That's number one. Number two, I think it's to really get engaged with education in the schools. We know hate is a learned behavior. I've said it before on the show. And it's imperative that people in the community are ensuring that their schools are implementing anti-bias training and initiatives, because these people that were standing there in Charlottesville with their tiki torches could have maybe been pulled in a different direction had they gotten the kind of anti-bias training that's so necessary when they were younger. And it's something that we must, as a population, especially here in New York, demand of our school districts and of our superintendents and school boards to ensure that these kind of things can be prevented, because they can. Not all the time, but certainly education is a tremendously big part of this. But, and also, you know, seeing something and saying something. If you see something that happens, if someone draws a swastika on your home or someone does something that you feel is, you know, inappropriate, is to report it to police. So many people are underreporting what's taking place out of fear of retaliation. The only way that we can really know what's going on and for people to make effective change is to understand the enormity of the situation. And we already have seen a lot of reporting clearly based on the numbers that we've put out in the last week, but it's imperative that people in our society really speak out when something happens, because if we don't speak out, then the other side wins, and we cannot let that happen.
And Evan, I also think, though, that communities have to band together. It can't be just Jews speaking out about anti-Semitism, the African-American community speaking about incidents involving racially motivated incidents or anti-Muslim incidents. All of these communities, all of our community, there's an incident now involving a Chinese nail salon. It's all of the communities have to come together and say racism of any kind, incidents, based on, you know, racist attitudes and racist violence. All of the communities have to stand together. It can't just be politicians standing next to one aggrieved group. It has to be all of the community members standing with local politicians and putting pressure on the politicians to provide the appropriate level of law enforcement and protection. And I think if all of the groups stand together and realize that we're all in this together, because if it's me today, it's you tomorrow, then we'll have a much more effective response.
No, listen, that's why our mission has two parts: tap the defamation of the Jewish people and secure justice and fair treatment for all. You know, I put out just as many releases, you know, offering rewards for people that, you know, they're not Jewish, that have been assaulted in our community. And you're 100% right. People have to come together. Rabbi Potasnik and I have had numerous conversations about this. And, you know, I think what happens is that people are afraid because maybe there's one or two issues in respective doctrines that somehow prevent us from standing next to each other. Whereas in the reality, maybe 80% we agree upon, and this 20% that prevents us from standing with each other. And we have to flip that script and realize that we have the 80%, and, you know, whether it's the Christians and Jews and Muslims and Sikhs and Buddhists and Shintoists, whoever it is, we have to be able to come together and, as you said, really understand we have a lot more in common. And once that happens, and standing locked and, you know, arm to arm, we have a lot more power together than we do as individual groups.
If I could bring a little bit of light into this area of darkness, thankfully in New York, we have built, and Evan, you've been a part of this, as others have, we have built a coalition of committed people of conscience who do stand together when there is an act of desecration, when there's an expression of anti-Semitism or any other form of hatred. We've been in mosques, synagogues, churches, anywhere, cemeteries. Whenever people are there who strike out against any group, we all stand as one group. We need to see more of that, obviously. But thankfully, we've established a foundation where we know we call each other. We don't just wait for, you know, the hatred to occur. We have these relationships that are strong, so we can pick up a phone and talk to each other as friends, and then when we need to come together, we do. More of that spirit needs to spread. The other thing I would add is the danger of ignoring, you know, the bigoted comment. There are those who will say something they think it's funny about a Jew, about a black, and the listener will just not respond. Instead of saying, I don't want to hear that. If that's how you're going to speak, I'm walking away. Because when you're silent, you acquiesce. You know, it's a form, it's a tacit form of support for the comment. And I think too many times there are those who say, well, you know, I don't want to ruin my friendship here, so let me say nothing. Or, you know, I don't want to ruffle any feathers, so let me just ignore what was said. That doesn't help at all. It's certainly not a good example for young people.
No, no. And we're seeing, listen, we see that on social media. That's the other challenge, is so much hate's online, so much of this hate that we're seeing when people are on Facebook with their friends, even young people with their friends, and they make these kind of comments as you talked about. You know, no one stands up for the other. And that's something that has to happen because so much is now on Twitter, on Facebook, and it's that's where hate is really gone. It's really gone online, and the discourse between people and how they communicate through social media is because they don't necessarily see the whites of their eyes or not even sitting next to that person. Mm-hmm. They can say things that they normally never would have said maybe 15 or 20 years ago, but feel very comfortable doing it now, and that creates a whole different kind of environment in our society. And that's where people have to stop that once they see it, as you said.
All right. Evan Bernstein, Regional Director of ADL. How fortunate we are to have you as one of the leaders of our community, and you stand up there for all communities. So I look forward to seeing you soon. And thank you so much for being with us today.
All right. Thank you so much, both of you. Thank you.
Right. Thanks, Evan.
Bye-bye.
Thanks.
Deacon Kevin McCormick. Rabbi Joseph Potasnik. Religion on the line. WABC. 77 WABC. 35 years ago, things were different in the world. But Religion on the Line was here, helping make sense of it all. Rabbi Joseph Potasnik and Deacon Kevin McCormick, 77 WABC.
Welcome back, Religion on the Line. I'm Rabbi Joseph Potasnik.
Sitting in for Deacon McCormick, I'm Alan Abramson.
And Deacon is taking some time off with his family, well-deserved, as we said, and will return next week. He and I are being honored by Save Our Aging Religious in September, and that's going to be a nice event. David Ushery is the MC. Alan, maybe we'll have you come.
I got the
if the
invitation.
Deacon doesn't show, you can fill in for him there as well. So, no, nah, but we'll all be there. Alan, you and I were talking during the week about the confrontation in Brooklyn, the nail salon situation, and what you said and what needs to be said is we need reasonable voices out there. Again, the extremes won't solve anything.
No, it you know, that's a situation. There was a dispute in a nail salon. It was between two people, and now all of a sudden you seem to have communities lining up against each other.
Yeah.
People from outside the communities are getting involved, and it's inappropriate. It's a situation that's getting out of hand. But I'm happy that my understanding is that there are representatives of the individual parties that are incredibly reasonable. Very, very smart people, and they are trying to defuse the situation and, you know, just calm down all of the communities that are involved.
All right. We're going to break now. I know that Joe has been patient on the line. We'll try to get to him. Tell him if he wants to hold on. We're going to have Mariano coming on soon, and then maybe after that we'll get Joe online. If not, for sure, next week when the deacon is here. I apologize for keeping you on so long, Joe. Let me thank Bruce Clayton, who is handling the board right now. Izzy Richardson, who's handling the phones. Two very capable people who make this a most enjoyable experience. Stay tuned. Religion on the line.
Religion on the line. 77 WABC. 77 WABC. Rabbi Joseph Potasnik and Deacon Kevin McCormick celebrating 35 years of Religion on the Line on 77 WABC.
Yankees win!
Welcome back, Religion on the Line. I'm Rabbi Joseph Potasnik.
Sitting in for the Deacon, I'm Alan Abramson.
All right, and now we have the great honor of going to someone I've come to not only know, admire, respect, I've come to love him. He's like a brother. I never thought I'd have a brother who played for the New York Yankees, but the great number 42, Mariano Rivera, who just returned from Israel on an interfaith mission with members of the New York Board of Rabbis. Good morning, Mariano.
Good morning, my brother. How are you?
All right. What a great trip we had. I'm here with Alan. I was telling him, we were blessed to be in Israel, to see things that had such an impact on our lives. There were so many things we saw, but I want to focus on a few. The visit to the hospital, Rambam Hospital in Haifa, where we saw an underground hospital. What did you think when you saw that hospital?
To me, first of all, Rabbi Joe, thank you for having me on your show. It's a privilege and honor. But when we saw the hospital, when we visited Rambam, and that hospital on the ground, it, to me, was amazing. Amazing, and the dedication that they have. And not only the dedication, but the determination that they have, regardless, whatever happened, they're willing to sacrifice their life for others. And that is what it is all about. You know, and I was so blessed that I was able to go there and see what they were doing in there. It's amazing, amazing. I was speechless. I couldn't talk about it because it's something that, it's fascinating.
You know, we sat there, and one of the doctors who came in happened to be Muslim. And then we heard about how the hospital treats Syrian refugees. You know, there's an old statement in one of the religious traditions that God has made one blood of the human family, that you don't make distinctions amongst people. And you walk into a hospital, and I thought to myself, you want to talk about a peace process? Here's a peace process. Everybody is the same. Everybody's an equal. Nobody gets preferential treatment. You base it upon, you know, sickness, and sickness crosses all religious lines. So it was something that will always remain with us.
Definitely, it was amazing. It was amazing, and you said it. You said it, man. They don't make a distinction between one person or the other. You know, one religion or the other. They didn't care about that. They care about human being lives. And taking care and doing the right thing. And like I said, you know, I mean, I was so happy and content the way they respond, the way the doctor was talking about. It don't matter who it was. As long as they has a need, they will step up.
Then we went to a military base. And you saw kids there. I mean, you were there with two of your kids. And here you see kids, you know, 18, 19, 20 years old, you know, defending a country. And I was talking to a parent yesterday, and he said, look, I would prefer my parent not have to serve, but we have to. We have to do it. Parents don't want their kids, you know, facing such dangerous conditions, but in Israel, it's a necessity. They are required to be part of the military.
Definitely, and it's a necessity, but at the same time, I was hearing this boys and young women and young boys talking, and they were talking about their forefathers defend the country with dignity, and now is their time to do the same, to defend their country with dignity, you know. And that to me was like so great. You know, I'm like, wow, these boys are something special. You know, and that's what it is all about. They are whatever it takes, you know, we need to do for our country the best. You know, and they gladly will do that. You know, it's amazing seeing these kids going forward. And by the way, I mean, they are boys and girls from all over the world, basically. Over, I believe, almost 30 countries they have there. And they're willing to defend Israel. It's amazing. To me, it's amazing.
Good morning, Mariano. This is Alan Abramson. Mariano, first, I have to tell you, I have a long overdue thank you to you and your family. I don't know if you remember, but it was a very special day for me. A couple of years ago, you invited Rabbi Ptasek and I to your church to celebrate Easter. And we came, and it's a beautiful church. Your wife is the pastor. And we walked in, and we were so welcomed by you and your family and the congregants of the church. And it was just such a wonderful, wonderful day. The day has stuck with me through these years. We were made to feel like family. We were made to feel so welcome. And I just, you know, at the end of the day, we said our goodbyes. But I just wanted to thank you for that day. It was really a very, very special day. And it was just such a beautiful congregation. And your wife led such a beautiful service. And it's really something that's been with me since we were there. And I just wanted to say thank you for that special day. That was really, really very...
No, Alan, it's our pleasure, man. It's our pleasure and our honor. And the door of the church is open for everybody. It don't matter. Race, color, language, it didn't matter. You know, it's open for everybody. And we're there to help, you know, and to bring... salvation to others. So, yes. Thank you, Alan.
You know, the name of the church is Refugio de Esperanza, Refuge of Hope. And meeting some of the members of the church reinforced the idea that this was a place, as you say, where doors are open. People who maybe have lost hope, who now found hope, because they realize there's a community that's welcoming them with open arms, not judging them, but saying, you matter, you mean something to us. So that's something here. Today is the anniversary of Charlottesville. We need to create more of those communities where people are included, where people feel I'm important too. I'm a somebody. Everybody's a somebody. So you do a great job. Matter of fact, Alan, we had to come back on the plane. Mariano timed it so we would be back at 5 in the morning so he'd get to services that day.
Wow.
And some of us went home to go to sleep, and he had to go to services that day. So, Mariano, people listening and saying, I don't know, should I go to Israel, not go to Israel? What do you say to them?
Oh, my God. You must. You must go to Israel. I mean, it's not that should I or should I don't. No. You must. To experience what you need to experience as a Christian and non-Christian, believe it or not, you have to experience yourself by your side, by your own flesh. You know, when you go to Israel, the Bible comes to life. And it's amazing, amazing sight. You know, I mean, you have to. I mean, regardless, you must go to Israel and find a special place. And you will come back. I guarantee you that you will come back again, at least one more time.
So,
but you must go to Israel, yes.
You know, we went there. I try to convert you. I try to make you Jewish. I try to make you a Red Sox. Couldn't do it. But you couldn't convert me either. It was just, you know, spending a week with you in Israel and with your family and your congregation and members of the New York Board of Rabbis. Keith Kantrowitz called me today. He says, what time is Mariano on? I never saw Keith sit so long, you know, for a trip.
Oh, and but, I can vouch for that.
But all of us were there. We were together as family. We were different and the same simultaneously. So I look forward to many more trips with you and being with you and bringing people together. You're a great messenger of hope. You embody Rabbi, the spirit of the church.
Rabbi, that's what it is all about, though. You know, it's bring people together, you know, with respect and love and kind. And, you know, and regardless who you are, it don't matter. You know, you have a soul that God wants, and that's important. You know, we don't talk about no religion. We talk about relationship. You know, we talk about, you know, just believe and enjoy life, you know, and be kind to others and love others, you know, and go. Yeah, we were with four or five rabbis, you know, and we have the best time that we can have. You know, we respect each other. You know, yeah, Christians and rabbis and Jews and all these things. Yeah, but the bottom line is the love is what drives us.
Yeah, the only thing that bothered me was the president of Israel, President Rivlin, and Ambassador Friedman both wanted to meet us. And I got an email that said, we can't wait to meet legendary pitcher Mariano Rivera. They didn't say we want to meet legendary rabbi. It was we want to meet legendary pitcher. Yeah. No, it was great.
Well, when you choke up that many saves.
Yeah. All right, look, say hello to the family. Thank you so much. Pray for peace. Pray for the peace of Jerusalem. Pray for the peace of all people.
Yes.
And let's be together many, many more times.
Amen, my friend. Thank you very much, brother.
Thank you, Mariano. Bye, Alan. Thank you, Mariano.
Number 42, New York Yankees, Mariano Rivera. But
that sounds good. That sounds good coming from you, man.
He's making a face,
you don't
Mariano.
Know how much pain, you don't know how much pain I'm in when I say
Mariano,
that.
Mariano, he's making
by
a
By the way,
face.
I do want to say this. On behalf of Boston, thank you for retiring. We're so happy you retired. You're a great human being. That's your biggest credential. That's your best statistic, is you are what we call a mensch, or in Spanish, el mencho. That's what you are. You take care.
Thank you, guys.
Bye-bye.
Bye, Mariano.
Love you guys.
Religion on the Line will continue right after this on WABC New York. 77 WABC. Rabbi Joseph Potasnik and Deacon Kevin McCormick. 77 WABC.
Welcome back, Religion Online. I'm Rabbi Joseph Potasnik.
Sitting in for Deacon McCormick, I'm Alan Abramson.
Deacon will be returning next week, taking some time off to be with the family. Let me mention a couple of things. Firstly, one of our listeners is a good friend. Jeff Sinnall was on the trip. He says, El Mencho? Don't you take Spanish 101? We learned that. Actually, that was a title that was conferred upon Herman Badillo, the great congressperson, first Puerto Rican to serve in Congress. He was given that title. I just conferred to people I think deserve it, and Mariano certainly does. Let me also mention that a good response to Charlottesville. He's going to be in Crown Heights today. One Crown Heights with a community that had endured so much suffering some years ago. We had the pogrom in Crown Heights. Well, today they're having One Crown Heights rally, celebration, parade, activities for kids, beginning at 11:30 on Kingston and Eastern Parkway. So you want to know what's an effective response to the Charlottesville hatred? One Crown Heights is one of those places where today you'll see community together. That's what this is all about. The word religion means to tie together. We have to do what we can to remove some of those barriers. And, you know, you look at the portion, Alan, yesterday, and it's a simple statement at the very beginning, really is the touchstone. It says, behold, I give you a choice, blessing or curse. If you choose blessing, life will go in this direction. You choose curse, it goes in a different direction. I think of that because it has meaning in so many different places. You go to Israel, and you see people who live under the fear of attack from Gaza, from the north, from Hezbollah, and it could be so different, but yet there are those who have an ideology of hatred which is taught from generation to generation, hate the Jews, hate the Israelis. What a missed opportunity. To be able to live a normal life, a beautiful life, but there are those who choose not to. They proceed on the path of, you know, the curse. Charlottesville, there are those who they want to destroy. Washington, D.C. today, right? It could be different. But again, they don't know what it is. They don't want to be different. They want to be you know, those who destroy. You can be a builder or a destroyer. I think better to be a builder, but some people think that's not the right choice.
No. I'm a little worried about what's going to happen in Washington today. They're not expecting anywhere near the kinds of crowds that they had in Charlottesville, but they're just worried about how they're going to contain the demonstrations that they have, what the reaction's going to be. Let's just all hope that it's just a demonstration, it doesn't turn violent, and spread out into the city.
Yeah. And look, we're going to spend time talking about hatred on the other side. You know, you look at college campuses today, you have kids. You worry about kids on college campuses who espouse a certain love for the state of Israel, because we've seen in California, we've seen in New York, where they're attacked, where they're assaulted, where you can't give a point of view without fear of suffering in some way, and that's not right. So that's another extreme, on the other side. You have candidates running for office on right and left, some of whom say Hitler was right, one of whom says the Holocaust never happened, a third one who says Farrakhan is the one who you should listen to, and they're all running for political office, and they're getting support.
From major parties.
From
major parties.
Right, on both sides.
And look, I am an ardent defender of the First Amendment. I will defend their right to take those positions and march peacefully. I've been criticized for that. But that doesn't mean that my political party has to run a candidate like that. That doesn't mean that I wouldn't, you know, oppose their views with every ounce of strength that I have. They have a right to hold those views and to speak to their speech. But we have to do everything we can to counter their speech with more speech. But for major party candidates to espouse those views, how does that happen? How did we get to that point in this country?
And we are at that point where they do have support. And the other side of it is there are those on the, you know, who oppose them, who are not vehemently opposed, who, again, who sit home and, you know, say, what a terrible thing, but don't do more to confront that hatred. But you're 100% right. The fact that we can have two major political parties in this country who have candidates who have been victorious or maybe victorious, who favor a Farrakhan, a Saussure, you know, who are saying Hitler. One of them says Hitler was right, I think the one in Missouri. And you get away with that?
Well, and I heard somebody say, you know, a candidate can't choose who supports him. Well, I disagree.
Yes, you can.
You can say to those people, I don't want, if that's what you believe, I don't want your support.
And that's what you should say if it really bothers you. I don't
want your support. And obviously, you don't understand the message I am trying to convey. Because if you believe that my message supports your message, then you don't understand what I am trying to convey to the people.
All right. All right, on this anniversary of Charlottesville, the question remains, where are we and what are we going to do about it? Well, I don't think we're in the place we should be, and we need to do more. Not simply sit back and say, let someone else do it, or there's nothing I can do. There's a lot you can do.
77 WABC.